Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Welcome to the Tech Central podcast. My name is Duncan McLeod. I'm here today with Jacques Lowe. Jacques is Director and Head of Cyber Defense, and that's a title I'd love to have, at MWR InfoSecurity in South Africa. This is the first of what I'm hoping will be a number of podcasts we're going to do over the next few months, looking specifically at cybersecurity issues, because it is such an important and growing space in the broader IT field. And I think it's worth spending a great deal of time, in fact, drilling down into some of the areas around cybersecurity. It's a big focus, not only, I think, for individuals who are worried about securing their information on the internet, but of course, also for companies. It's become a pivotal focus. In fact, I was at an IDC presentation this morning where they said that it's the fastest growing area of spend in the IT industry and is forecast to continue to grow faster than all other categories through to 2020. So it's a big focus area for everyone. But Jacques Lowe, I'm really pleased to be able to kick off this series of cybersecurity discussions with you today, and to talk to you about something quite specific, and that's threat hunting. We'll get to that as the podcast goes on a bit, but I want to start by just finding out a bit about MWR InfoSecurity. I've heard the name, but I don't know much about you guys. You're a British company, right?
Yeah, so MWR was started in 2003. We've opened up offices all over the world. The South African office was opened up in 2008. We also have offices in Singapore, Poland, the US, and a small office in Germany. Mainly our focus is, or used to be when we started in South Africa, certainly the focus was on sort of more offensive work, so doing things like penetration testing. So fundamentally, we would try and simulate or do the kind of attacks that real attackers are doing against large organizations. So typically our customer base has been large financial services organizations, so the big banks. So essentially our job was to go in and you know, try and find the vulnerabilities that attackers would exploit. So kind of white hat hacking, I think, sometimes called, although I know that's a bit of a loaded term these days. So let's just call it, you know, penetration testing. So, you know, as a security consultancy, we've kind of moved on, and, or I wouldn't say moved on, but certainly moved into other areas. So certainly my focus now and a lot of MWR's focus has shifted from doing that really offensive work to getting much more involved in actually helping organizations defend themselves against these attacks. So, you know, there's only so much you can do by pointing out the faults. You know, the focus for us is really to start supporting our clients a lot more and actually helping them deal with these problems.
So it's a pure consultancy focus. Do you sell any products at all, or is that completely out of your area of domain?
No products. We like to remain independent.
Sure.
That said, we do offer some managed services. So, you know, we're talking about threat hunting today, so one of the managed services that we do have is Countercept, which is our managed threat hunting service, which we're effectively outsourcing that capability to MWR. But otherwise, no products. We try to remain, you know, a consultancy for sure.
Okay, great. Well, just coming out of this IDC presentation I attended this morning, it's you know, I think it's a bit of an eye opener for people who don't focus on this all the time, just how big the problem has become, particularly I think in the last 5 years, it's really mushroomed, and I suppose people have become more aware of it because of discussions about you know, the NSA and Edward Snowden, and I think people are more aware of things like encryption, and certainly the industry is focusing on more on it now, and it's even becoming a bit of a political hot potato, for example, in London, in the UK, just in the last few days, in the wake of the attacks outside Parliament. The politicians were again saying that they want backdoors into WhatsApp. So it's becoming a bit of a political issue as well, I suppose. So the industry is really becoming the focus of ordinary people, I guess. And I suppose that's a good thing, given the risks and the need for people to be aware of what's happening. What's your broad view of how the cybersecurity space has changed? I mean, you've been in it for a number of years. What's your take on how maybe just the general public and companies have changed in their approach to dealing with these issues?
Well, coming into this quite new, as a student, this is my first job, starting to learn the ropes here, it very quickly dawns on you how insecure many systems are and how accessible the information to compromise these systems are and has been for a long time, So while there have been advances made, for a number of years, we was all sitting around going, when are the attacks going to start happening? Mm. It kind of seemed like it had to happen in a sense. So I guess what we're seeing today is really almost in a sense, security debt of a lack of focus back then. Mm. And we've allowed this to get to the situation now where these systems are now being targeted and being targeted very effectively. So I think that's been driven largely by a change in the kind of people who are perpetrating these attacks. Mm. I think when you're talking a decade and a half ago, the majority of the kind of incidents that were happening were primarily based around things like, viruses.
Sure.
And a large majority of those viruses were simply nuisance, the kind of things that make your screen pointers disappear or make your computer crash, make your computer slow. There wasn't really malicious or not commercial malicious intent there, by which I mean that there weren't really large organizations who were using that or at least had identified a way to commoditize that and to actually make money from that process. And I think that's been the major change we've had in the last, half a decade certainly, but potentially even more. I think another big change that's happened is there's been a change in legislation in some areas, specifically in the US, where there's a far stricter requirements in actually reporting these kinds of crimes. I think today, more than ever in the past, it's becoming more acceptable to actually disclose the fact that you have been breached or compromised in some way. And I think that's really opening the doors. I mean,
is it becoming more acceptable, or are companies disclosing it because they're being forced to by regulators?
Well, certainly, in South Africa and in a lot of African countries, the regulators are certainly not enforcing that in the majority of cases. I struggle to think of even some tangible cases that we've been involved in that they were forced to disclose. So I think even today, the majority of cases are being investigated and are being handled behind closed doors. It's only really in some jurisdictions where there really has been enforcement of this kind of thing, where you're seeing this information come out. But I think, that has kind of helped to make companies feel that they can actually talk about this kind of thing happening. When it's happened to all of your competitors, it's far easier for you to admit that it's happened to you as well. And I think that's in large part led to the greater visibility we've had recently.
Mm. Okay. Do you think that, just as an aside, do you think that companies should be forced to disclose when they've had information breaches? Do you think that regulators should get involved? And is it in the interests of consumers to know, to have a regulator force a company like a bank, for example, to disclose that someone's compromised their systems?
Yeah, that's a difficult issue to discuss. And if I put myself in the position of the organizations that are getting compromised, I can certainly understand why they wouldn't want to disclose this kind of thing. Reputation, there's certainly a lot of damage that happens on the back of this kind of thing. But, on the flip side, for the rest of us as the general public, certainly there's a huge advantage to knowing these attacks are happening, primarily because, being forced to disclose the fact that these attacks have happened means that it's much easier for you to then speak to the other organizations in your industry, in your sector, and actually share the kind of details of how these attacks have happened. I think that was, something that happened very slowly a decade ago, and we're starting to see happening a lot more. These days, where organizations are willing and able to actually share some of the indicators of compromise, talk to each other around, how do we get compromised? And that really does help bring up the level of security across the industry.
Mm. Now, I know you can't mention specific clients, but what are some of the risks? What are some of the cybersecurity issues that your clients are facing? What are they actually seeing? What attacks are being mounted against them? What's actually being successful, and what sort of damages are we seeing as a result of those attacks?
Yeah, so for MWR as a company that works primarily in the financial services industry, in a sense, it's kind of predictable. What comes next is the prime target is financial assets, right?
Yeah.
So in the past, I think there's been a lack of understanding and sophistication in the groups that have launched these attacks. And I say groups, I think in often cases, they may well have been individuals launching breaches, these companies. And in those cases, you know, they go for the easy things, the things which are technologically at least easy to understand, i.e. database records, you know, customer mm-hmm. records, these kinds of things. I think now we've seen a far greater sophistication in the organized crime groups that are mounting these attacks today. They have the ability to actually pay for experts that understand how to move money out of these organizations, how to move this money around the world and make it very, very difficult to recover any of it. They have large networks of people who are skilled and organized at really taking this electronic money and cashing it out, mm-hmm. turning it into something physical, which, you know, at that point is virtually impossible to ever recover again. So I think, you know, certainly that increase in sophistication has led to a far greater number of attacks really targeting direct financial assets. And I mean, the damages we've seen, certainly the ones that have been publicly reported, mm-hmm. We've seen the attempts on the, you know, some of the very well publicized breaches, like, you know, things like the Bank of Bangladesh, which I'm sure most of your listeners are familiar with, you know, where the attempt was made to steal $1 billion, you know. Failing that, they got away with a couple of, you know, nearly $100 million, and I mean, these are large numbers, you know, and that for a central bank to lose that kind of money, this is the kind of mm-hmm. thing that could potentially destabilize economies. And if you look at how the only reason that it didn't succeed, by most accounts, is that there was a typo in the actual instruction to transfer that money. So you can very easily see that a lot of these kinds of attacks are happening. But you know, primarily, I would say that the typical attacks we're seeing are in the range of something between, let's say, 50 and 500 million rand.
Okay.
So those are the kinds of numbers the guys are hitting, and they're doing that to basically fly under the radar. Those are the kinds of numbers that organizations can still get away with not disclosing, I think.
Yeah. And I'm interested in what you say. I mean, this is organized crime. This isn't individual hackers targeting these institutions. It's big organized criminal organizations that are hiring technical skills to break into these banks and steal money.
Absolutely. I wouldn't say the other attackers have gone.
Yes.
You know, I think they're still around, but in the, you know, in the grand scheme of things, in the current threat landscape, yeah. You know, that's not where the primary risk is represented today. I mean, when you're thinking about, okay, an attacker who is potentially politically motivated and you know, has some kind of gripe with a large organization and takes down their website, I mean, there's a slight reputational damage, but I mean, in today's landscape, someone's website was down doesn't even make the news anymore, you know. Mm. So really, in the broad category of risk, yes, I think absolutely the shift in focus needs to be towards these organized crime groups.
Now, you work with South African financial institutions. Where are the bulk of these attacks coming from? Are we seeing a growing criminal enterprise within the borders of South Africa that are mounting these attacks, or is it primarily coming from other parts of the world?
Right, so we're going to touch on a very sensitive and much discussed issue, which is attribution, and really, I mean, it's very difficult to even speculate where these attacks are coming from. You know, even if the money is transferred to a bank in, you know, wherever, it doesn't really matter, right? Because, you know, these syndicates spread across the globe. So even saying that they're coming from a specific country is it could be a complete misnomer. You know, these groups are spread out between, you know, the traditional hotspots, which are, you know, the Eastern Europe, China. We've seen a lot of really ability for these organized crime groups to operate freely because they, in a sense, support the agenda of the local governments. You know, the governments in China and in Russia are able to use this as a, in a sense, a cloak, right? So whatever's attributed back to a Russian group can easily be, you know, attributed to an organized crime group, you know, or to something government related. And having these groups functioning and actually launching real attacks allows them to almost hide behind that, in a sense, right? But I mean, to get real hard and fast data on these kinds of subjects, you know, really requires you to be an intelligence agency, and a lot of this is mainly from, you know, the kind of public sources we've seen, but also, you know, in terms of geopolitical motivation, and we can see what motivates these large countries to actually launch these attacks, and so, you know, a lot of this does make sense, but proving it, you know, to 100% level, yeah, I think very difficult
indeed. Great. Well, let's get into the meat of why we're here today, Jacques, and that's to talk about threat hunting. I think as a starting point, if you don't mind, just define what threat hunting is. And if you don't mind, also maybe just discuss how it differs from traditional cybersecurity techniques.
Yeah, okay. So I think the problem we have today is that threat hunting is becoming a bit of a buzzword. So everything that does attack detection is now doing hunting. It sounds like the right thing to do. Unfortunately, you know, with something becoming a buzzword, the actual meaning behind that gets lost. And I think there are a couple of different definitions for this. But I'll speak to you about what MWR believes threat hunting is.
Sure.
So for us, when you look at the kind of traditional techniques that have been in play for over a decade, you know, the traditional kind of logging and monitoring of network traffic, these things haven't worked. And then the kind of key thing behind them is that they operate on rules or signatures that essentially create alerts. So really, the detection portion is automated or sits almost in a technology space, where really the humans come into play when it becomes response. In other words, an alert's been generated, and now we're responding to these alerts. What threat hunting does at its very core is really to change the focus and put humans back into the driving seat. For humans to take the burden and the brunt of that detection work and really apply keen thinking to the problem and applying a lot of expert knowledge to this problem versus relying on an automated system to do that for you. And I think, you know, these kinds of automated approaches were, I mean, they were relevant. They worked when the attacks were equally automated, right? Mm-hmm. When you have a virus that is self-propagating, that isn't driven by a human, you can apply an automated defense, because as soon as you know how to stop it, that's it. There's no change, there's no update until a new version is released, right? But when you're dealing with a human, he can actively interfere with you, right? This is a live adversary, and that really changes the game, which means that, you know, fundamentally, if you want to block a human attacker, you need a human defender. Mm. That's really what it comes down to.
Okay. So, my understanding is that the traditional threat detection techniques, you're not advocating replacing them, but that humans need to be introduced back into the equation, perhaps the way they've perhaps been removed to some extent, to offset these risks. Now, a lot of the attacks online are automated, right? I mean, they're automatically testing vulnerabilities on systems and trying mm-hmm. to find ways in. But what you're proposing is the only way of fighting a criminal who's trying to get into your system is to match him with human skill. And am I getting it right?
Yeah, that's exactly spot on. So, you know, if you take a bit of an example on this, is what you really have here if you think of your enterprise as a house. You know, you can apply controls on various areas. So the first area you could apply is on the prevention side, and this might be something like a wall around your house, right? Mm-hmm. So you can keep building these walls higher and higher, but eventually the attackers figure out how to make a ladder that's slightly higher, and that's what we've seen. So the shift really has changed towards detecting and responding to these attacks. The detection would be something like the tripwire or the laser beam or the alarm system on the inside of your property, and the response would be kind of the armed response that arrives. So Gartner estimates that 60% of cybersecurity budget will be spent on detection and response by 2020, which is, I mean, that's a huge shift, and that gives you a good idea about really how ineffective preventative controls have been at stopping these attacks. And the main reason for that is that the attack surface has grown hugely. When you look at what attackers were attacking, you know, let's say a decade ago or something like that, you know, primarily these attacks were being performed against internet exposed systems. So your website on the internet, you know, your firewall on the internet, whatever was exposed, and that would be the entry point. There'd be a weakness or some kind of vulnerability in those systems. And when you look at the number of things that are on the internet for a large organization, that pales in comparison with the number of, you know, employees and systems that are actually on the inside of that network. Attackers quickly caught onto this problem, and essentially what they've done is changed their focus from really attacking that internet-based infrastructure to targeting the users and the employees on the inside. So they are now using combinations of social engineering and really, you know, endpoint targeting malware to compromise systems on the inside of the network, you know, that completely bypasses all your perimeter controls.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of organizations have been stuck in this kind of, you know, very hard shell, very hard perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
But once you get on the inside of the network, there's very little defense. So as you rightly point out, I mean, these internet-facing systems are getting tested constantly. They're constantly being attacked, but they're very rarely succeeding in being attacked, right? So the attackers are not succeeding in these methods. So the sophisticated attackers, the attackers that actually know exactly what they want to achieve, are using methods where they're targeting employees. So really that changes the burden on the organization, where now they had to harden a small number of systems on the outside, they have to harden their entire internal perimeter. Now there's a number of ways you can do that, right? You can put extra preventative controls in place and you can prevent people from doing their job. Now, I mean, my experience certainly has taught me that this is not a very effective way to go. And, you know, as soon as life becomes harder for users on the inside of the network, you get pushback. And I think that's been one of the core drivers of detection and response. When you're detecting the attacks, the users can still do what they need to do, except that you're now in a position to actually mitigate that by detecting attacks. And then responding to them appropriately, of course. So I think a lot of these things have driven the kind of change that we've seen in the move from prevention to detection and response.
How does threat hunting help in the internal company situation? I mean, I presume if you've got a rogue employee or someone on your payroll who's been paid off by a cyber criminal to steal information off a system, that you could still employ traditional cybersecurity techniques inside the organization to detect, for example, whether information is copied onto a USB drive, mm-hmm. that sort of thing?
Yeah, so that's something we would typically call something like an insider attack. So if you've got a malicious insider that's operating and he has legitimate access, there are certainly controls that you can use to really investigate and see what he's doing. And that largely is based around behavior.
Mm.
Now, I mean, ultimately, this is a very hard problem to solve. But when we look at some of the really big attacks that have been launched, you know, insiders might be involved so far as they are potentially used to actually install malware on one of the endpoints, if social engineering is not an effective technique for that organization, although, you know, experience has shown largely these techniques are still very, very effective.
Yeah.
So what we're really looking at is these kinds of groups that are breaching the perimeter, landing on the internal systems, and then from there moving on and actually compromising those servers, you know, those workstations where these assets are lying. So if we go back to that analogy, I think, you know, our house analogy was a bit simplistic, and what we're really doing with a large organization, when you look at this network, is it's almost like a city.
Mm.
There are, you know, a number of roads in and out. You know, there are people walking through the entire city constantly. You can't have laser beams everywhere. People need to be free to move to actually work effectively to live. And in that same kind of analogy, what we need to be doing here is, if you look at the kind of traditional approach, which is very much a signature-based approach. So if you look at how antivirus works, you've essentially got a system which is looking at a new piece of bad thing. So let's say this is a criminal walking around in the city, and what's being done is, you know, as soon as this criminal is caught, you take a mugshot, and then you look at the CCTV cameras across the city until you see that criminal again, and then send the police, right? The problem with this approach is that it ignores the kind of common sense things, right? So when you have a real policeman walking around the city, he doesn't rely only on what the criminal looks like.
Mm.
You know, a real criminal, you know, you could have facial surgery or whatever to change your appearance. Now, for a malware author, that's far, far easier to actually achieve. It's a small code change to bypass these signatures. So what you really need to do is focus on that kind of manual, real police, a real human that can judge what this activity is and whether this activity is wanted or unwanted, rather than just relying on an automated system based on predefined rules.
Okay.
So that rule set is never going to be complete.
Before we move on, to what extent does the education of employees play a role in protecting a company's secure defenses? To what extent does, I mean, I'd imagine that for your average employee, it's more of a frustration than anything else being told what he can't do by the IT department because it might be a security risk, especially in this era of cloud computing where you could work as a team and pop a whole bunch of stuff up into some cloud service. And I'm sure it happens all the time without employees even thinking about that might be a risk to the company in terms of providing sensitive information into the cloud or mm-hmm. into some service without the permission of the IT department. To what extent does the IT department actually work with end users in the organization to sensitize them to security, and how important actually is that?
Well, if you look at it from the perspective that a large majority of these attacks are actually targeting the end users, there's clearly a need for work there, and there can clearly be improvements made there.
Yeah.
But ultimately, you know, the approach has been to get people to not click on the links, right?
Mm-hmm.
The problem you have is something we call, you know, the defender's dilemma, right? Is that only one user has to click on that link, only one user has to open that attachment. So you have to be at a position where you have 100% of your employees not clicking on these things 100% of the time.
Which is impossible.
Yeah. yeah.
Basically.
I probably agree with you, yeah. I don't think we've seen anyone get even close to that when you look at the statistics. So really, what I would recommend is a change in focus. So instead of getting users to not click on those links, obviously it's important that they don't click on the links, but in a sense it's even more important that they report the bad emails.
Mm-hmm.
So even if they have clicked on a link, even if they have submitted a password, or even if they're just seeing something suspicious, having them report that suspicious behavior or that suspicious email is far more useful.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a team that actually can take that email, look at it and say, oh, this looks very suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let's investigate where this has come from. Let's actually deal with this threat and contain it before anyone else clicks on it. That's a lot more of a fruitful approach, I think, to rather telling people what not to do is to help them in supporting you in detecting these attacks rather than just relying on everyone to always
do
be
the right
on
thing.
Their A game. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So if I'm an organization and I'm interested in threat hunting and establishing a team in my organization that can do this, what is the most effective way of going about that? How do you assemble an effective threat hunting team for your organization?
Yeah, so certainly, I mean, to have a team is useful. You need to have some level of tooling in place. They need to have basic understanding of how that tooling works. But ultimately, this is kind of where we diverge from the traditional approach, which is, you know, looking at the data, the systems automatically generate the alerts to now, the team will be responsible for actually doing that investigation. Now, this requires, as you might imagine, a slightly different employee or analyst to actually do that job. And what we found that, you know, the most important thing is that you have analysts that actually understand how these attacks are perpetrated, how they work in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have understanding of how a particular event fits into a wider attack path, you know, an attacker has to take multiple activities from breaching the organization to actually making a payment out. So if you see an event, you need to be able to place that into the sequence, really predict where this person has come from, where they're going to go to next, and to really identify where they've been, where you've been compromised and how to isolate them. So that kind of understanding really comes from sort of two places. You can definitely get a little bit into it from a theory perspective, but ultimately our experience has been that these people come either from an offensive perspective where they've perpetrated these attacks themselves, so
mm-hmm.
normally not the kind of black hats
right.
that are doing this for criminal gain, but rather, you know, people that have been doing this kind of testing in a consultancy role or penetration testers, that kind of thing, or from the other side where you've been responsible for investigating these kinds of breaches. So once a breach happens, an incident responder gets called in, and that person really has to dig through all the data and all the forensic evidence that's left behind to really understand and unpack how the attack happened. So both of those things, I think, are the primary ways for you to get a really deep understanding of how these attacks.
I was just about to say, I'd imagine that someone with forensic skills would be ideal for this sort of work.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I think, and so you know, I don't think a team could consist of only one of those two skill sets. I mean, we're saying threat hunting is a skill, and I suppose there's a component of it which is the skill of the actual people who work in a team. But I think threat hunting is more a process or a collaborative effort. You know, you can't have one person that is doing threat hunting.
Mm.
It's a team effort, right? So there needs to be people that are doing research. You need people that can actually digest all the new information that's constantly out, you know, on every platform imaginable about how attacks are actually being performed. You need people that are pushing the offensive side of things, that are actually performing these attacks and discovering new techniques at the same time or even before the attackers discover these techniques. You need people that can actually take that experience, turn it into something useful, and come up with a scenario, right? We've never seen this attack, but we theorize it could be possible, and then goes looking for those attacks. I mean, that's the only way you can really catch these attacks. They happen the first time. Otherwise, you're always going to be catching them the second, third, or fourth time. So if you want to catch them the first time, really, you need that pipeline to come all the way from research, you know, working through scenarios, and then actually being able to mine the data effectively and to actually see whether those scenarios have taken place already.
What is the best practice way of establishing a unit like this in your organization? What are the local financial institutions, for example, doing? Are they creating isolated security teams that perhaps report into someone else other than the CIO, or are they sitting within the IT department reporting into the IT director? What is the best practice approach? Where should these guys sit, and why?
Right, I mean, that's a difficult question to answer at the moment. You know, this is kind of a very new a new area still for everyone, and I think a lot of organizations are still figuring this problem out. I don't think anyone has the perfect answer right now. So often I think this depends on the organization. I can give you some comments on where I've seen these kinds of functions work very well within organizations. So typically the things that can go wrong is to isolate this team and have them sit on their own, you know, somewhere in the corner of a building. Typically, they work at their best and most effectively when they are part of a wider security, you know, operational security team. So being integrated with the IT teams, with the security teams is really where that core focus needs to lie. They can't be put off in a corner somewhere. So that generally means they report to sort of IT security. However, I don't think that's as important as the kind of culture around them and the relationships they can build with the rest of the team to actually do their job effectively.
Mm. Okay. So as organizations establish these teams, what's in their toolbox? What are the tools of the trade?
Yeah, so as I was saying, you know, there's a huge amount of human capability and process to mine this data, but ultimately you need to collect the data and have some way to query it. So when you look at the kind of very traditional things that people have done, it's been effectively you have a collector component and you have some kind of database. So these can be anything from free and open source tools like, you know, something like an Elasticsearch database, or it could be, you know, very expensive commercial solutions that are available. You know, there's hundreds of these available. There's no shortage of them.
Right.
And most of the big security players have a solution in this space. But ultimately, you need a way to get logs from devices and potentially network traffic have been the two traditional sources, and put them into these collectors. Sometimes these collectors are referred to as SIEMs, so Security Information Event Management Systems, and they allow you to basically query and timeline and sort this data in a way that makes sense. Now, that traditional space kind of has one enormous blind spot, and that is basically the endpoints. So you can imagine if you have, you know, even if you manage complete data from every network point and you have data of all the logs on all your servers, you know, you might see a connection to a file server. It's very difficult to tell that this connection has been made by a legitimate user or by a piece of malware. They're using legitimate, you know, a traffic protocol. They are using a legitimate service. They are using legitimate credentials. What you really need ultimately is to have visibility of what's happening on the endpoint. So as you mentioned before, you know, forensics seems like a good skill, yeah? And what we need really is forensic tools as well. Mm-hmm. The problem with old school, you know, traditional forensics tools is that you have to, you know, more often than not, you have to walk to a machine, gather that physical evidence, process it in some way, and then begin to analyze it. Now that process could take days or, you know, more than a week. You know, you can't respond in that kind of time, you know, across an enterprise with hundreds of thousands of endpoints on it. So there's been a kind of development of a new kind of tool called EDR, or Endpoint Detection Response Tools. So typically these tools are agents that sit on systems, so servers and workstations. And what they do is really provide you the ability to query each of these systems and gain, you know, really in-depth detail about the operating system itself, about the processes that are running, how they're running, which network connections are getting made. I mean, if you can think of it, these tools, you know, largely implement those things. So it gives you enormous flexibility and an enormous, you know, ability to gather information. But obviously, with this information, you need techniques to actually process this. And I think that's where a lot of the challenges come. So perhaps I can give you a bit of a view there. What we've seen really is that these EDR agents are going in almost two directions. You know, we've seen a part of the market, potentially I think the bigger part of the market, which is split off and is becoming more automated. In other words, more rules, more intelligence is being built into the agent itself. And again, it becomes the agent's responsibility to give you that alert. You know, and when you put a human attacker against this kind of ability and he's sophisticated and skilled, they will install that agent on their own systems and they will develop techniques to bypass them, right? On the other hand, you have the other kind of branch of EDR tooling that is really becoming developed more and more towards threat hunters, and are really built for human consumption. So, they focus much less on automation, much less. They don't have embedded signatures, but they provide the analyst or the threat hunter the ability to really go look for the things that they find interesting. So I think there's kind of a split happening. One is going sort of the antivirus automated route, and the one is really supporting this new threat hunting technique.
Well, speaking of automation, and maybe by way of summing up, Jacques, there's a lot of excitement in the broader IT industry at the moment about artificial intelligence. How can we apply AI tools, machine learning ideas in the space? We talk about involving humans more in helping offset or build our defenses against cyber criminals, but to what extent do you think machine learning is going to allow companies to fight the scourge of cybercrime?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting topic to actually discuss. When we're talking about AI, the kind of dream that's been sold is that it's going to replace human analysts, right? That it's going to take the job of humans and actually do this more effectively, faster, better. Anyone who's involved in the IT, or especially the IT security sector, knows that, skilled resources, skilled people that actually can do threat hunting, that can really operate at this level, are very, very rare. And so any business that's being told they can spend, CapEx, a once-off payment, and they get this piece of software that can replace that human, that's the dream. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I don't really buy that at the moment. What we've seen is that machine learning is an incredibly powerful technique. Ultimately, it's an algorithm, right? Mm-hmm. And these algorithms are ideally suited to problems that are very well defined, that are very complex to solve, and perhaps time consuming to solve. So they provide a lot of efficiency, they provide a new perspective to look at this data. What they lack is the ability to interpret a broader problem space. Mm-hmm. So when we're looking at something like threat hunting, you need to, as we spoke about before, it's really about taking fundamental research, research that didn't exist yesterday, that exists today, turning that into an understanding of how this could be used to attack an organization, theorizing scenarios, and then applying that to the data. This is an enormously broad and complex task. And what we've seen with today's AI techniques is that they can be hugely useful and they can be applied to great effect to solve specific problems within that space, but certainly not replace the end-to-end solution. So our view is that machine learning is a hugely important tool and will probably become a more and more important tool as time continues. But ultimately, it's just another tool that's in the arsenal of the threat hunter and certainly not near the point of replacing what a threat hunter does.
Right, so the cybersecurity experts can breathe easy. They still have their jobs.
For now.
Jacques Lowe is Director and Head of Cyber Defense at MWR Infosecurity in South Africa. Jacques, thanks so much for being on Tech Central.
Thank you very much for having me.